From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means our reporter roundtable is here with us today. We're going to get you updated on the news that made headlines this week. And today, our panel includes Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, and Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hey, Gemma. Happy Friday.
Thanks for having us.
So, Nate, I want to start our conversation today with you because Lori and Chad Daybell were back in court yesterday. Walk us through what happened there.
Well, this was a kind of a procedural hearing, I guess you could call it, as the trial is getting closer and closer. It's scheduled to begin in the beginning of April. And there were several motions that were discussed. One of the most interesting ones is that Lori's attorneys are saying that her constitutional rights are being violated because she has not had her trial within 6 months of being arraigned. In Idaho, once you're arraigned, you have 6 months to have a speedy trial unless you waive that right, which is what happens in most high-profile cases. But Lori has not waived her right to a speedy trial. And so her attorneys are saying, because this trial isn't starting until April, it's over the time limit and that the charges in the case should be completely dismissed. Now, the prosecutors are saying, you know, there were some different circumstances with this one. The fact that the trial's being moved to Boise and there were some scheduling issues. Also, Lori Vallow was incompetent for a few weeks. And because her case is tied to her husband's, there were issues with that. So they're arguing that, no, the case shouldn't be dismissed. You know, I don't really think the judge will dismiss this case in the end, but it was an issue that was brought up along with some other issues about the jury, what kind of questions the jury will be asked before they're picked, and things like that.
Okay, so at this point, then, we are waiting to hear what the judge decides, but if the judge says move forward with the trial, it begins, what, in less than 2 months, correct?
Yeah, it begins April 3rd, so about 6-7 weeks away from now, and Lori and Chad are being tried together. His attorney plans to fight that. He wants them severed. He wants separate trials for each of them, and he's making the argument that he's still waiting on DNA evidence to get back to him, and that when he gets that evidence, he's going to need several weeks for his expert to process it. Frankly, looking at the calendar, he doesn't have that time because the trial is scheduled to start. So the question becomes, does the judge separate them because Chad Daybell has the right to a fair trial and has a right to go through all this evidence, but Lori Vallow wants it taken care of and wants the trial done. So that's going to be discussed at a hearing in 2 weeks where this trial could be split up, or the judge could say, no, it's been 3 years already. We've got to get this thing processed and move forward.
Okay. So, Jimmy and Audrey, I know both of you have been at the State House this week covering a very controversial issue, and this is gender-affirming care for transgender youth. And Jimmy, I'll start the conversation with you. Talk to us about this bill and the fact that it did make it through one Senate committee.
One House committee. Yeah, no worries. So this bill would essentially make it a felony for any doctor to prescribe a transgender minor puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or perform any sort of gender-affirming surgery on them before they're 18. And this is a bill that has kind of made the rounds for a while. I think our first one in Idaho was in 2020, if I'm remembering that correctly. But they haven't really gone anywhere. That particular effort was held in committee. And then, last year, the House voted for it, but the Senate didn't want to take it up. So we're still waiting for the House to vote on this. Seemingly, it would probably pass. And then it would be up to the Senate to decide whether or not it goes forward from there. But, in the hearing, we heard more than 2 hours of testimony from both parents and doctors and even trans kids themselves as to how important this is for them. Of course, there were some doctors that opposed it. And most of them, except for one that I think was actually from out of state, as far as I could tell. Like I said, this has been making the rounds across the country. Utah just recently enacted a similar law. So it's certainly not an issue that's going away.
And Audrey, your thoughts on this, because I know you've reported on it as well. You know, in particular, as Jimmy mentioned, there were a lot of people who testified in regards to this bill and the importance of these transgender youth getting gender affirming care.
Yeah. And I think for me, the thing that kept sticking out was the conflict between what this bill would do, which is to essentially go over limit parental rights and limit health freedom, limit provider mm-hmm. rights, ability to practice. And it was in conflict with a lot of the folks who voted for this bill. It conflicted with their votes on other things, vaccinations, masks, sex ed, where parental rights have been sort of the keyword, right? So mm-hmm. in this case, you had people voting against parental rights, against provider independence. And even the folks in the committee acknowledged it. Representative Cannon from Blackfoot said, the criticism that we who talk about leaving decisions up to families and parents, I mean, that hits home. And I don't know exactly what to do with that, he said. But in the end, you know, you've got to go with your gut. And I'm going to support this today. Representative Young from Blackfoot, she said that this was not a matter of being selective. It was a matter of trying to find the limits on what's an appropriate parental right and parental authority. So it was a really interesting piece of this. And Eve Devitt, who's a 17-year-old trans girl, she even pointed that out. She said, if you care about the rights for parents to choose what is right for their kids, like you stated you did just earlier today, then you will vote against this bill.
I think that's such a good point, Audrey. And you know, I think that therein lies so much of the issue, is that I think we have legislators who pride themselves on parental rights. You know, that it's like parents should choose. Parents are the ones who get to say what they can do when it comes to their children, except for this. So we will see how this moves forward. With that said, Audrey, a patient was just awarded more than $13 million in medical malpractice suit. You wrote about this. This is pretty unheard of here in our state.
Yeah, Idaho has a cap on damages, non-economic damages, for medical malpractice. To get mm-hmm. past that cap, and it's quite low. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah,
so to
it
get
is. It's
past
very low.
That cap and get into the millions range, you have to be able to show that the provider's decisions were reckless, or the healthcare they provided was reckless. And so in this case, they did show that. The case goes back to 2015 is when this patient was cared for in an emergency room here in the Treasure Valley. He had a stroke. It took several hours to get admitted, and then several hours to get an MRI to be able to determine that he was having a stroke. And you know, there's lots of backstory there, but ultimately, after filing a lawsuit in 2018, most of the parties settled. So the hospital settled, individual physicians, a radiology group settled the case, but Emergency Medicine of Idaho, which is, if not the largest, then one of the largest emergency medicine groups in the state, they ended up fighting it. And so they did not win that fight. And a jury awarded $13.5 million to the couple, including the patient who it sounds like is no longer able to work, has trouble with movement now, and of course has gone through a lot of medical care as a result.
Mm-hmm. And now they can still appeal this, Audrey, but as of today, this decision by the jury stands.
Sure. Yes, they absolutely could appeal it. And then we also have, you know, there are situations where medical providers have insurance for things like this, malpractice insurance. And so we might see more kind of interactions with that. I don't know. In the past, you know, you've seen medical malpractice insurers declining to pay out or being willing to pay out. And so I think this is not over necessarily, but as far as this verdict goes, yep, it was one of the largest. It was the second largest in Idaho history.
And then Audrey, staying with healthcare right now, St. Luke's just announced some fairly significant layoffs.
Yeah. So they announced that they're cutting 2% of their workforce. About half of that, though, has already been accomplished through attrition. So they are eliminating some positions they described as non-clinical administrative. As with any healthcare organization right now, they are still struggling to get and to hire and retain frontline healthcare workers. So they're trying to move kind of the layoffs into that area. The reason is obviously it's complicated, but it can be, you know, I could sum it up as ripple effects of the pandemic and the federal aid that we've seen going to healthcare providers over the past few years is winding down, because the national emergency is winding down. And so they're kind of in this position where labor costs are still really high. They still need to be paying people more than they were before the pandemic, but they're not getting that aid that they were getting during the pandemic.
Okay. So Carly, let me bring you into the conversation, because, you know, we have talked on this show numerous times. Idaho Ed News has reported on this. And this is a mental health crisis that we know we have in Idaho. Statistics show that, data shows it. And now you're learning that our state's student to counselor ratio far exceeds the recommendation. Can you talk about this?
Sure. Yeah, I was talking to a school counselor a couple of weeks ago, and she was telling me that she has over 500 students on her caseload. And I said, gosh, that seems like a lot. And she said, well, in fact, it's double the recommendation from the American School Counselor Association. So they recommend a 250-to-1 student to counselor ratio, but it's actually very common in Idaho and throughout the country that schools exceed that. So the national average ratio is 480-to-1, and in Idaho, it's 400-to-1. So there's certainly not as many counselors as that organization thinks that there needs to be in schools.
Wow. Okay. So Jimmy, education is a big topic at the State House this session, as it has been for the last couple of sessions. Can you tell us about Governor Little's launch program? Let's start with what it is. He did discuss this, I know, in his state address at the opening of the legislature this session. But where does this stand now? Because there's been a lot of back and forth about this.
Yeah. And so we had the House take a vote on it earlier this week. It passed with one vote. Wow. You know, it was by the narrowest of margins. And this program would give high school graduates in Idaho $8,500 that they could use towards any kind of training, certificate programs, or a college degree if they lead to needed jobs in the state. Now, that's something that would be kind of determined by the Idaho Workforce Development Council each year. Mm-hmm. They would try to figure out, okay, we need X amount of welders and X amount of plumbers or X amount of lawyers was one of the other careers mentioned in one of the debates. You know, and then that money would get funneled towards any sort of education that would get someone certified for that. So you had a lot of Republicans basically calling the bill socialism, not the proper role of government. Representative Julianne Young, for example, said that the program shouldn't solely target high school graduates, you know, talking about people who might have been laid off and want to try another career, or just adults who never finished any kind of career training, maybe. You know, this would cost about $102 million in its first year. Most of that money would come from funds that was set aside by state lawmakers during last year's special legislative session. And the rest would come from eliminating a couple different scholarships, the Opportunity Scholarship and Post-Secondary Credit Scholarship. So now this goes to the Senate, where earlier this week, there was some controversy about it not going to the Senate Education Committee, which has a lot of more conservative and far right legislators on that committee, and instead going to the Senate Commerce Committee, which seemingly would be more favorable to the bill. So it still needs a public hearing on that side, but it seems like Senate leadership is trying to fast track this around more conservative members.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Jimmy, didn't some of the more conservative members, the argument that they have made is that basically this is, a handout. This is socialism, just giving kids $8,500. But with that said, there's also this group that's really pushing the idea of school vouchers, right? Of giving families that money to decide where they want us to send their children to school at K-12, whether that's public, private, charter, however that looks. So, how has that discussion been a part of it? And I guess, is that also one of the reasons why they're trying to circumnavigate this particular faction of legislators?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting facet to this whole issue, right? That wasn't really addressed during the committee process or on the House floor. It might come up in the Senate, but I something that I could imagine them saying is that taxpayer money following the student through, whether it's, an education savings account or a voucher program, these are children, whereas the adults who would be high school graduates, at least most of them, should be paying for their own education. We heard that type of argument, though not necessarily with a tie-in to any sort of education savings account.
Okay. I want to stay with the education topic for a bit. And Carly, Idaho Ed News, you did a deep dive this past week on school districts and charter schools where at-risk students are actually outperforming state ISAT averages. So what did you learn in your reporting in terms of what these districts, these schools are doing differently?
So some of the standout school districts were Bonneville and Nampa. So I talked to their leaders to kind of see what is different there. At Bonneville, they've got some really unique Mondays. So mornings are for students to go in and catch up, get help from their teachers, and they can spend as much time in classes as they need. So they can spend the whole morning in math class, for example. Then they go home in the afternoons, and that time is for teachers to get together in what are called professional learning communities. And so they work with their peers, they get on the same page, they support new teachers. And one of their goals is to make classes equitable so that no matter who your teacher is, you're getting the same pacing, expectations, and that kind of thing. So at Nampa, I talked to people at Endeavor Elementary, and they have some really unique programs. One thing they're doing is bringing a therapist into the school that teachers can meet with every week or every other week. And that's been really essential for retention and helping teachers that have been especially stressed after the pandemic. Something else that they have at Endeavor that's really interesting is on-site childcare for new moms. And that's helped with retention efforts as well. And the reason retention matters is because that stability in teachers and caring adults really helps all students, including at-risk students. They also do co-teaching in the Nampa School District. So they'll bring in a language specialist to help with reading and certain things like that. And so in those classes, you've got two teachers at once, which helps more kids. And the last thing that they have is community resource centers. And that's basically a place where community members can come for whatever they might need, whether that's food, hygiene products, clothing, school supplies, or help with applications or job searches.
And these approaches, Carly, are they, do you think other school districts will look into this and maybe implement some of these ideas? I mean, because just to see the data on this is pretty incredible.
Well, every district has its own unique needs, but I certainly think other districts are looking at this. I know at Endeavor, they've had other districts like West Ada come in and observe their co-teaching. And so other places are looking to do that. And then community resource centers, that's starting to become more prevalent. And it's kind of similar to what's called a community school model, where basically schools are starting to work with community partners to make sure that not only students, but families throughout the community are well supported. Because we know that students have to have their basic needs met in order to care about, you know, that math test or that book that they're reading in school.
Yeah, we actually just talked with the folks from the Napa School District just yesterday about the these community resource centers and really the incredible job that they're doing. Nate, I want to bring you back into the conversation. There was such a heartbreaking story out of Fort Hall last month. There was a little boy who was killed. He was attacked by a dog. His mom tried to save him, and she recently spoke with your team. Nate, talk to us about what she told you. And truly, I mean, the fact that she was able to even, I think, do this speaks so much about her, because she also had to recover physically from what happened, let alone if she'll ever be able to recover emotionally.
Yeah, this was really a heartbreaking conversation, but she wanted the world to know about her son, 7-year-old son. They were living on Fort Hall in a trailer behind the mother's aunt's house. So they had stayed in this RV type of trailer for quite a while. So they weren't new, and the dogs belonged to her aunt. There were 4 dogs. And so they knew these dogs. They were friendly with the dogs, played catch with the dogs. I mean, there was never any sign, according to this mother, that there were any issues with the dogs. And just, I think it was about a week and a half ago now, her son came back. They came back from the arcade, and he had earned enough tickets to get a little ninja set. Sorry, I'm going to decline that. And what happened was they got out of the car. They went inside. The mom went inside with her 5-year-old daughter, and the little 7-year-old stayed outside. And that's when he didn't come back inside. She went outside and found little Kellen lying on the porch, and the dogs were their tails were wagging. They felt that they were just fine. And she went over to pick up Kellen, and that's when the dogs attacked her. And she was trying to save her son, and she described the heartbreaking scene of just kissing his face, saying, "I love you, you know, I love you." And as the dogs are attacking her, and then her 5-year-old walks out of the trailer because she hears all of the commotion. And this mother, Emily, said that if she didn't distract these dogs, they were going to go after her daughter. And so she let them continue to attack her as she yelled to her daughter to go inside. And eventually she was able to call for help, and the dogs were put down immediately when the police arrived, and they rushed both the mom and the son to the emergency room, where he passed away. And she was still recovering at the time she gave us this interview, and just spoke about life and how precious life is, and how she will miss her little boy, obviously, but she wanted to get the word out that, you know, don't take life for granted, and it's important to tell those you love that you love them.
Mm-hmm. And Nate, I know that you said the dogs were put down. Do we know if charges, anything like that will happen? I mean, you don't want to think about that, but I mean, because it's such a tragedy, but I mean, we've seen that happen in other cases like this.
Yes. So the dogs were immediately put down. The owners of the dog, her aunt and husband, I believe they were charged with, multiple counts, and because this is on Fort Hall, it's a little different than the legal system that you and I might be used to, but they were facing multiple charges. It has opened quite a broader issue, at least here in Eastern Idaho, that apparently this is an issue on Fort Hall. These dogs that feral dogs that are apparently just on the loose. There's lots of dogs, and the Fort Hall Business Council came out with a statement with their dog ordinance, saying after this that if animal control sees loose dogs, they have the right to immediately put them down, you know, if they're causing any sort of issue. They want residents there to realize that they're taking this serious. They're actually hiring an additional animal control officer to keep this intact, and they want people to contact them if there are violent dogs. So it seems as if the Fort Hall leadership wants to respond and make sure that this doesn't happen again. I mean, granted, this did happen on a private property and the dogs were not loose, but yeah, the owners of the dogs have been charged.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that update, Nate. Jimmy, some Republican lawmakers want to make cuts to our state's unemployment benefits. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So this was just introduced Thursday for anyone who's listening today or later in the program. But this bill would essentially cut in half, almost in half anyway, the length of unemployment benefits that can be obtained. So right now, people in Idaho who are laid off or otherwise qualify for the program can get up to 20 weeks of unemployment benefits. But this bill from Representatives Julianne Young and Bruce Skaug would take that down to 12 weeks if the unemployment rate is 5% or below. Now, it would index it to, the unemployment rate. So every 0.5% that it would increase by, you would get another week. So essentially, you wouldn't get the current amount of benefits that Idaho offers unless the unemployment rate was 8.5% or higher, which it hasn't been for a very long time. We've been well under 5% for a while now. Now, this was kind of presented as, well, you know, if there are more jobs out there, then people should get back to work. And if there aren't any jobs, then sure, we can offer more benefits here. But the thing is that this rate would only be calculated once a year. So if there are, you know, let's say sudden massive layoffs, you know, a huge recession, which is not currently predicted, happens, then, you know, people would be out of luck unless the new rate was going to be updated, which it's supposed to be toward the end of the year. It also wouldn't take into account any kind of regional fluctuations. Clearwater County is pretty rural in north central Idaho and is usually one of the highest unemployment rates in the state. You know, that can get as high as like the upper 5%, where it has recently. Meanwhile, you'll have, you know, maybe Rexburg or Teton County, for instance, that have unemployment rates that are, you know, in the high ones. So like 1.6 or 1.9%. So it would just take the totality of the entire state and kind of make it a, you know, one size fits all program.
And so you said this was just introduced yesterday. So what is the next step, I guess, in this?
Yeah, so it would still need a public hearing in the House where it was introduced, and then it would go on to the full House before, you know, if it's approved there, then it could go to the Senate.
Okay, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens next then with that. So, Carly, the Idaho Falls School District tried to pass a pretty hefty bond last year. It failed. So what are district officials thinking of doing next? Because I think to say that many of these schools and the school district in particular, Idaho Falls High School, they have some very concerning issues going on right now.
Yeah, they really do. At Sunnyside Elementary, for example, they have so many students that closets, storage spaces, hallways, and the principal's office have all become impromptu classrooms. The principal no longer really has an office. She just grabs her laptop, works in the foyer, and there's similar issues going on at Idaho Falls High School. So they've talked about a range of possibilities for how to solve this in light of its record bond failure. So one thing they talked about on Wednesday was putting a 10-year $3.25 million plant facilities levy on the ballot to help pay for a new elementary school. And this is interesting because a plant facilities levy would only require 55% voter approval, and that's as opposed to the two-thirds approval needed to pass bonds. So when their large bond, their $250 million bond, failed in the fall, it passed with 58% support. So if they decide to do this, it would kind of be a unique approach to the problem.
And Carly, Can you talk a little bit about some of the problems that some of these schools are facing? Because I know you've reported on this in the past, but I mean, we're talking some very old buildings with a lot of problems, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of it's safety. I mean, the hallways are really narrow. There aren't as many exits as there maybe should be. So there's usually questions about evacuations and how would that look in an emergency scenario. But I want to point out too that what's happening in Idaho Falls, we see that play out across the state as well. Districts' facilities needs are building up across the state, and so their bonds are becoming more expensive and more challenging to pass. And with that required two-thirds threshold, nearly half or 48% of bonds have failed since 2000 in Idaho. So in addition to Idaho Falls, the Middleton School District had a failed $59.4 million bond. And at their Mill Creek Elementary, the lunchroom, staff lounge, hallways, conference room, and individual office spaces have been used as classrooms. And if we look over at the rural Salmon School District, they have an extraordinary 0 to 12 record of bond failures since 2006. So they really can't count on ballot measures for major upgrades. And they've got issues such as outdoor food storage, a cracked foundation, having to house a majority of elementary kids in modular buildings outside of the school building. So not just in Idaho Falls, but throughout the state, there's a number of facilities needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So Nate, I'm curious about this. You recently reported that there are some major UPS or United States Post Office delays going on
USPS.
Right now.
We could,
USPS. Okay, let's be clear on that. So USPS. I don't want to throw UPS under the bus. So some big delays going on, and we could see impacts across the state.
Yeah, we got looking into this because we had some severe weather about a week or two ago, really cold weather, and people were calling our newsroom saying, I'm not getting my mail. The mail's not showing up. And we figured it was because of the weather and the major storm, which that did play a part. But as we got looking into this more and more, people were saying this has been an issue for the past year or so. And so we reached out to the USPS for, you know, comment to figure out what's going on. And they tell us that they are severely short-staffed, as are many businesses across Idaho. Mm-hmm. And they need mail carriers. They need mail sorters. They need all sorts of office workers. And they just can't get the employees. And that is impacting customer service. And they, even in Eastern Idaho, they're saying, just so everyone's aware, customers, you might not get your mail on Monday, but you'll get that mail that would have come on Tuesday. And those people that don't get it Tuesday will get it Wednesday. So they're trying to figure out what to do here. The USPS is required by law. They have to deliver every single item sent through the mail. So they've got to get the packages out, the letters out, and they have employees working overtime to meet that. But we've seen mail trucks out in Eastern Idaho at 8 o'clock at night, still delivering the mail. And they did want to warn everybody that this could expand statewide in Twin Falls or Boise, wherever. And they're currently holding job fairs just to try to staff up and get back so that there isn't such a delay in getting your mail.
Well, I have to say, Nate, just anecdotally, I mean, I've seen postal trucks in my neighborhood in the evening. And the only reason why I know that, I mean, that it stuck with me was that I was surprised to see a mail truck out so late.
Yeah, you don't really see it out in the dark. Maybe at Christmas time, you know, maybe in December you might see it, but not in January or February. And personally, I didn't receive any mail for 2 days, but when I got there on the third day, it was quite a bit. And these jobs are pretty decent paying. You know, they're $19 to $20 an hour and you get the benefits. And again, they're just having that issue that so many employers seem to be having, that they can't get the workers.
Well, and good to know they have those job fairs, because as you said, those are some good jobs if people are looking. I want to thank all of you for coming on today and spending the time with us. Really appreciate it. We've been talking with James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, and Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News. Audrey Dutton did join us from the Idaho Capital Sun for the first segment of the program. Have a good weekend, everyone. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Jemma. You too.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.